From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we look back on a landmark in Milwaukee history, the start of 200 nights of open housing marches. We'll speak with a man who was front and center during that time, Prentice McKinney.
We didn't start out marching saying, okay, if we march 200 days, we're going to accomplish something. No, it was, we're marching today. And you get out there and, well, for me, they piss you off even more and you say, I'm coming back.
Then we'll talk about cybersecurity and internet-connected devices, from your fitness tracker to your car.
And Radio Chipstone introduces us to a woman looking at the pervasive nature of racism in Wisconsin's history.
It exists in housing, it exists in the types of jobs that people can have, and it's not in the historical record enough, it's not spoken about enough, so I'm interested in helping to rewrite the history.
Plus, the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Exactly 50 years ago this past week, civil rights activists took to the streets for the first of 200 consecutive nights of marches.
They marched from the north side of Milwaukee over the 16th Street Bridge to the city's south side. They were demanding a law to end discriminatory housing practices that prevented African Americans from living in white areas of the city.
A teenager named Prentice McKinney was at the center of those marches, leading a group called the NAACP Youth Commandos. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Aisha Turner sat down with McKinney to learn about his fight for civil rights here in Milwaukee and how that reverberated across the nation.
So how many questions have you got?
It's about 1:15 on a Tuesday afternoon. It's clear that I've interrupted Prentice McKinney's day. He usually doesn't wake up until noon, so it's still early.
We run a bar. We're up 5-6 o'clock in the morning.
A cup of coffee sits on the glass desk in his living room. Prentice owns the night spot downstairs, Savoy's, off of Locust Street. This afternoon, he's getting ready for his Tuesday night wing special. He taught himself to DJ 5 years ago. He's practicing when I show up. It's my
command. So I'm just sorting the music flow that I want to play today.
He points to a gray chair next to his and offers me a seat.
I smoke, so put your lungs at risk if you'd like.
Before Prentice bought Savoy's 20 years ago, it was called Turan's.
And this is where everybody came to get together after the marches. I think I was 18, 19 when I first came in here. I don't think I was supposed to be in here, but that's beside the point.
It was the spot for conversation and laid-back music.
Chill for a moment, and then somebody says, oh, I got an idea, and here we go again.
Prentice is almost 70 now.
I'm still young, still had 20 years in front of me. I'm still kicking.
He says that energy, the same energy he drew on as a 19-year-old member of the NAACP Youth Council, actually comes from his anger.
Too often we look at the issue of anger and say, anger means we will destroy something. Anger also affords us an opportunity and an energy level to build something.
Prentice has built a life and a legacy of civil rights work, focused on confronting the injustice he's seen for African Americans. During the open housing marches in particular, he was a youth leader with the NAACP Commandos. Commandos march with activists to protect them against crowds of violent white counter-demonstrators and hostile police officers. It was a natural outlet for Prentice, who felt the lash of racism stir his anger at an early age.
I had two brothers that were in circus. The one who was in the Air Force had been in Europe for a while, decided he was coming back to Milwaukee to buy the family a home. He was in uniform. Him, I, and my mother get in a car, and they've got a couple spots picked out to look at properties. So one is up here on 24th and Capitol. He drove up, saw the for sale sign. We all get out of the car. Nice neighborhood, whatever. And at that point, I'm young. I didn't know that they didn't sell houses to African Americans in certain neighborhoods. So we walk up on the porch. He knocks on a door. White lady comes. Said, see, you have a sign for house for sale. We'd like to take a look at the house. She looked at him. Oh, gosh, no. I could never sell to niggers.
That didn't fly with him.
You don't call my mama no nigger. My brother dragged me off the porch, and that's when I became aware of my anger at being treated differently. Just simply looking at your skin and saying, no, you're not good enough for this.
He was about 15, maybe 16 years old. He noticed how differently his mom reacted. His parents had grown up as sharecroppers in a small town in Arkansas.
Seen or heard about people getting lynched, KKK coming down to people's houses in the middle of the night. I mean, so her experience with white people had taught her to be afraid. You know, you do what masters say do. So I didn't have that inherent fear that someone would do something to me because I stood up for myself. And so when I got involved in civil rights, that was her greatest fear. She went and took out a life insurance policy on me. She feared that deeply that they would kill me.
For Prentice, his manifestation of anger in place of fear would pay off. A young white priest named Father James Grappi showed him how to channel his anger early on.
We met at a fight. They moved the Freedom House in on 15th and Belit, and me and my little crew were on 14th and Belit.
The Freedom House was a gathering place for the NAACP Youth Council and its Commando Defense Unit. It was established in 1966.
And so when they moved into the house, it was our hood. We had to go check them out. In the process of checking them out, I had a little gang called Quick Fist and the Retouchables. Of course, I was Quick Fist. So we went around looking out for our territory. And I ran into Dwight Benning. Dwight was probably 6'3", probably 250 pounds. Bass in his voice. So we had a few words, and next thing you know, we're ready to knuckle up, you know? And Grappi pulled up.
Father Grappi was an advisor for the Youth Council.
Down to earth, average, cool kind of person. He persuaded me that maybe we could work together to make our community a better place. And so I ended up joining up.
Together, they marched for better education, to pick up the all-white Eagles Club, and eventually, on August 28, 1967, for housing. Vail Phillips was the first African-American woman to serve on Milwaukee's Common Council. She spent years pushing the city government to outlaw housing discrimination. She first introduced a bill in 1962. It was defeated 18-1. She tried three more times. Each time the bill failed. So in 1967, she teamed up with the NAACP Youth Council. They needed to make people pay attention. The Youth Council and its supporters marched along the 16th Street Bridge. An old joke claims it's the longest bridge in the world because it connects Africa to Poland. Marchers made their way from the city's predominantly black north side to its white south side. The marching would go on for 200 days. Vail Phillips told the Common Council they were out of excuses.
That nobody is free until everybody is free, and we intend to march, all of us, until we get just some of the basic freedoms that are ours. If ever a matter demanded the urgent attention and forthright action of this Common Council, this is it. Gentlemen, the time is now. Thank you.
When the fair housing marches began 50 years ago, Prentice McKinney had no idea how long they would last.
We didn't start out marching saying, okay, if we march 200 days, we're going to accomplish something. No, it was we're marching today. And you get out there and, well, for me, they piss you off even more and you say, I'm coming back.
On the first night, the marchers were met with a hostile crowd. Thousands of people on the south side shouted obscenities and threw rocks and bottles at the demonstrators. On the second night, the same thing. And on that second night, when marchers returned to the north side, they discovered the Freedom House on fire. The Youth Council held a rally in the front yard the next day. A young, pissed-off Prentice McKinney took several deep drags of his cigarette while journalists gathered around him.
The fire was premeditated in my mind. It was premeditated, deliberately set by the police force.
The police department was accused of treating black people unfairly for years.
Because these cops walking around here with guns, man, got as much sense as a orangutan with a balloon.
Why would a policeman want to do that?
Well, first of all, man, why they wanted to do that, they don't like us down there. And they figure that this is one of the ways of moving us out. But one house don't stop, no show.
During the marches, Prentice received a letter. In the backdrop of the civil rights movement was the Vietnam War. Prentice was 19 years old, registered for the draft.
I had to make a decision. Muhammad Ali said, Vietnamese ain't never called me no nigga, so I ain't got no problems with them. I got problems with the ones calling me nigga, okay? Well, I felt very much the same way. No, I'd rather go to jail. Over there, I'd probably have to kill somebody or get killed. This country wasn't worth that for me.
He was eventually reclassified. His fight was here, not in Vietnam. The movement grew. Supporters joined the cause. Half a year later, in the spring of 1968, the streets were full.
It's amazing the power of television. People started seeing it in the news, the local news at first, and then you'd see the numbers starting to build up. Well, when the national news came in, CBS and ABC, well, then the numbers just increased and increased.
Ultimately, the marches ended on March 14th, 1968, without a fair housing law for the city of Milwaukee. And then, less than a month later, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. That galvanized passage of the 1968 Civil Rights Act. It's also known as the Fair Housing Act, signed into law as a national ban on discrimination in housing. That happened thanks in large part to the publicity generated by the housing marches here in Milwaukee. After King's death, the NAACP Youth Council chose to honor him with a march through the inner city and downtown.
On Martin Luther King's death, I mean, I stood, I'll never forget it, I stood on the corner of 3rd and North Avenue after marching down Wisconsin Avenue, and I looked back towards Wisconsin Avenue, and the street was wall-to-wall people, wall-to-wall, of all colors.
People marched in silence, except for the occasional singing of We Shall Overcome. 3rd Street in Milwaukee is now MLK Boulevard. And after fighting against fair housing legislation, the Common Council renamed the 16th Street Bridge the James Grappi Unity Bridge. Anger can destroy or it can build. 50 years and a little bit of hindsight later, Prentice is able to see the manifestation of his work. For instance, now that African Americans can live in more districts, there's better representation on the Common Council. In theory, there's also better access to schools and public facilities. Of course, there's still a long way to go.
You turn around and you look and you say, what real difference did it make if Milwaukee was the most segregated city then, 50 years ago, and still is today? What real difference did it make? But when you look from a political standpoint, then you understand that there has been some progress. Don't give up.
I'm Aisha Turner, 89.7 WUWM. Special thank you to WTMJ-TV, the Wisconsin Historical Society, and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Libraries for the use of archived materials in this story.
Prentice McKinney was the leader of the NAACP Youth Commandos, one of the primary groups involved in the 200 consecutive nights of marches demanding an end to housing discrimination here in Milwaukee. The first of those marches took place 50 years ago this past week on August 28, 1967. Prentice McKinney spoke with Aisha Turner. A long time coming, but I know
a change gonna come. Race and ethnicity reporting supported by the Doman Company.
We'll take a quick break now and then return with the latest edition of Radio Chipstone. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
More of Lake Effect Weekend now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. During the late 19th and early 20th century, the Fox River Valley in eastern Wisconsin was a segregated town, essentially built for and by white men of means. Irishmen and African Americans living there suffered the most, with women and children close behind.
Those men working in the Fox River Valley paper and wood product factories faced 12-hour days without breaks and were paid less than a living wage.
Women who worked alongside men were paid half of their male counterparts. Leisure time was rare and came at a high price. In this edition of Radio Chipstone, UW-Madison doctoral candidate Jillian Jacklin tells contributor Jennifer Fields that before workers had rights, surviving as a working woman in the Paper Valley was difficult.
Primarily, women couldn't find themselves in leisure spaces unless they had to one, rely on a man to help them pay for whatever it is that they were hoping to do. They would, in some cases, spend all their wages in order to go see a vaudeville show or go to the local theater. But in many cases, there wasn't money for leisure, they would end up at home. So when men started to see women, single women increasingly in spaces of leisure, they would wonder how they got there. And in many cases, women would turn to sex work for more money in order to be able to have leisure, in order to pay their bills as well. But it was really difficult to go out and enjoy your time after work because there wasn't a lot of extra money.
So then what's the reaction as far as corporate entities and the law? What happens in an effort to control these women with now what's perceived as free time and money?
Heightened laws against the existence of women in these spaces in general, and an attempt to shut down any business that will, for instance, serve alcohol to a woman or allow women to enter the establishment. So there are increasing restrictions, and so women would find themselves sometimes in jail. In local jails, they would arrest women, but also in local reformatories and sanatoriums and places because law enforcement and corporations would actually seek out laws and measures to restrict women from participating in these leisure pursuits.
So Jillian, how are women taking care of themselves? Are there organizations? Are they getting together? How are women navigating this world that seems to be so stacked against them?
Often women would look to their surroundings to build some sort of sense of community. In some cases, women would go to their local churches. They would go to temperance societies. But in other cases, they would look to women in these leisure establishments as their friends, as their allies, as people that they could organize with. Even though we don't often talk about it, especially in smaller communities, like in rural communities in Wisconsin, for instance, that women were organizing along suffrage lines, were trying to find ways to maintain the vote. And reading, I think, is a big way that people informed themselves on what was going on, writing letters, and then really trying to find themselves work in factories where they could learn what was going on and how to organize from the beliefs of men who surrounded them. So constantly trying to gather information in an effort to undermine the restrictions that they were finding in their lives.
Are we seeing women who are married to men with money reaching down to help their sisters?
I believe that the answer to that is yes and no, because it depends on the way that these wealthier or more influential women are looking to sort of, I don't know, either help or befriend or create a better situation for factory workers, for instance, is often like more of a scorning or more of a how do we, quote unquote, reform these women to be more moral members of society? I haven't come across a lot of information of more financially well-off women or women married to men with means actively trying to improve the lives of women in smaller communities. Other than religious endeavors, which are important, very much so, and activities like through the YMCA, reading groups. But in most cases, these women of means are gathering together to do things that are really disconnected from the lives of workers around them.
That's what it seems like, Jillian. It seems like it's always, I call it the Butterfield 8 syndrome. If you've ever been a sex worker, if you've ever had to step outside of what is approved by society in general, what the community will bear, Your only way to get out of it is either death or religion.
I can't say that the information I've come across says that there's anything different besides what you just said. Of course, there were people who did, but certainly society, larger society of wealth is more so like you need to help yourself kind of mentality rather than trying to organize relief efforts or social welfare to help people. Rather, it's like people are in this position because it's their fault, not because of the larger systemic inequalities.
What is it about this topic, Jillian, that brings you here?
I grew up in a working class family in the Fox Valley and very much deeply lived the segregation, I believe, in the area as far as It's very divided along class lines, and although like racial and ethnic minorities are growing, or the population percentage is growing, the community is rather wealthy. The area is pretty wealthy, supposedly, but I didn't grow up in one of those areas, so I know that like this image of the area isn't complete. And so I've been interested in understanding like the history of where this image comes from, who else lives in the area, and I'm very committed to publicizing that systemic racism exists in Wisconsin. It exists in housing, it exists in the types of jobs that people can have, the places that they can eat, and it's not in the historical record enough, it's not spoken about enough, so I'm interested in helping to rewrite the history.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting the collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
We'll take another break now and then talk about whether today's wearable technology is a convenience that comes at the cost of your privacy. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee Public Radio. Back now with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Think about all the things you have that connect to the internet. Your smartphone and your computer, obviously. But then there's a fitness tracker on your wrist, or the app in your car that lets you check whether you've locked the doors, or perhaps it's your TV set.
It is the Internet of Things, or IoT, and it's changed the way many of us live. But it's also exposed us in new ways to hackers and other people who might seek to do us harm. So how safe are we in the IoT landscape? It's a question Jen Rathburn wrestles with quite a bit. She is a partner at Foley and Lardner and co-founder of the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance, and she is with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So the Internet of Things has grown exponentially in recent years. Consumers have more and more Internet-enabled devices in their homes and in their pockets, and businesses are using more of these as well. Let me start with a really simple and maybe obvious question. For every internet-enabled device, should we assume that there is someone out there working to exploit its vulnerabilities?
Most definitely, yes. In fact, at a lot of the large hacker conferences, such as DEF CON and Black Hat, many of those security researchers actually, have sessions on how you can exploit those types of devices. And yes, unfortunately, those devices, bring risk not only to consumers who use them, but businesses who purchase them.
I would be lying if I didn't say, as I was preparing for this interview, I was glancing at the Fitbit on my wrist, and thinking about the kinds of data that it collects and what someone might want to do with that data.
Exactly. I think one of the biggest issues with internet-connected devices is really consumer understanding about what data is being collected and how is that data being used. I mean, oftentimes, when we allow someone to use our data through a connected device such as a Fitbit or others, we think, okay, well, they're using that data in order to provide us a service. But in fact, oftentimes there are secondary purposes in which the companies are using that for. And so that's one of the things that is evolving in this space. And, the FTC follows this because they have the responsibility for consumer protection, and the FTC has lots of recommendations. But essentially, it's, how transparent are companies being with consumers about what types of data are they collecting and for what purposes are they using that data, and what consumers, what consumer rights do consumers have to control that use of data?
Right. One of the distinctions that I was reading about is this idea that often you see that such and such a company will never sell your data to a third party. But that in itself doesn't necessarily mean they aren't sharing that data in some way, right?
Yes. It's also the age of big data. In addition to all of these devices being interconnected, companies are really focusing in on big data. And so the question is, okay, well, yes, you're collecting my data, and maybe you're not selling my data that's fully identifiable to a third party, but maybe that company is getting rights in that privacy notice to aggregate data or de-identify data. And, you know, one of the things, though, I would say that gets very confusing, and I work with a lot of companies on developing privacy notices, sometimes it's difficult for companies to predict how they're going to use data 5 years in the future, even 6 months from now. And so I would say that for both companies and consumers is really looking at that privacy notice. What are you putting out there? Are you being transparent? And the FTC is watching those privacy notices as well. Oftentimes, if there is a breach of information, a security incident, a hack, you know, the FTC will look at, well, what kind of privacy notice did you provide to consumers? Did you promise that the security of their information would be protected, you know, in what manner?
You mentioned these privacy notices, and you know, they are often when we sign up for something online, we'll have to check that we've read and understand the privacy notices that they've provided for us. And realistically, a lot of us just click that box and go on with our lives. These privacy notices are not always written in such a way that's really easy for people. I would imagine even people who know the field to understand.
Yes, and that is one of the things that the FTC is trying to work on and give guidance to companies. I mean, consumers do have responsibility. You can't just say, well, I clicked on it. I have no responsibility. I don't know what happened. But that is definitely a problem. I mean, those consumer privacy notices, if you make them too complicated and consumers don't understand, then really, they're not useful in the end anyway. But that is the tug and pull in the space about what are consumers' responsibility and what are, you know, companies' responsibility with regard to providing consumers information about what they're doing with their data.
And I know you are not a computer engineer here, but one of the issues that I have read about in terms of security vulnerabilities that's apparently most common is, say, firmware that's not updated frequently enough. Where do things, in your experience, go wrong the most often?
Well, I think where things go the most wrong are when companies develop a device, they don't take security by design into consideration. And oftentimes, especially with startup companies or other things, they're just trying to take a product to market. And they're not thinking about, okay, well, this is a great product. It does all these wonderful things. There's all these benefits to business and consumers. But they don't think about, you know, what types of security vulnerabilities are in those products. How are we going to update and patch those products after, you know, they're purchased? How long would we continue to do that? And what's so interesting about that is we have seen the Senate proposed a bill August 1st. It's called the Internet of Things Cybersecurity Improvement Act of 2017. And what's really interesting about this bill is, I mean, it's the first effort and push to try to protect internet-connected devices. And what this bill would require is that manufacturers that are selling IoT devices to government to, you know, implement certain security controls and think about things such as what you just mentioned. What are the security vulnerabilities? Are you going to be able to patch that device, you know, not using hard-coded passwords, you know, among other things? And really what we see in the legal space is oftentimes there are bills passed that affect government entities at first, but then those become standards that are pushed down to, you know, the private industry.
But again, this is where consumer responsibility comes into the picture as well. When a firmware update or a patch is available, there is some requirement on us as consumers to update it.
Yes, and that's where the FTC comes in. The FTC actually issued comments on the process aimed to improve the security of the Internet of Things back in June. And really what this was is a discussion about what should manufacturers tell consumers and what are consumer responsibilities. So, you know, one of the things they recommend to manufacturers, again, this is just guidance, it's not law, but when you see what the FTC comes out with guidance, manufacturers should take that into consideration because you know that if there's a issue down the road, these are the types of standards that the FTC is going to look at. And one of the things is, you know, does the device, can they receive security updates after it's purchased? You know, how will the consumer receive those security updates? And, you know, when will support of this device end? And I think that there is that pull and tug between, yes, manufacture. You have to do security by design. You need to think about security vulnerabilities. You need to think of ways in which that device needs to be patched. But you also, consumer, we're not here to protect you for the rest of your life of this device. You know, you need to understand when maybe you have the responsibility to do updates, et cetera. And so the FTC is really trying to provide advice and commentary about how, you know, really these issues should be addressed.
Can you do a little dot connecting for us? I mean, I'm sure there's still listeners out there who are thinking, you know, who wants to hack my toaster or my thermostat or my light switch? What are the risks when you have an internet-enabled device, no matter how innocuous that device is?
Well, I think one of the best ways to understand the risks of IoT devices are, I mean, if you think about a virus or a disease spreading, when you connect to the internet and you have these devices, whether you bring them into your business or you bring them into your home, it allows someone to potentially come in and infect and get access to your data in many new ways than we used to see before. And, you know, sometimes hackers just want to do it because they just want to prove to the world that they're able to hack this device. I mean, that's one of the things in those big conferences that I mentioned. You know, companies will be sitting in there, and some of it is just security researchers proving that it can be done. But, you know, we worry about things such as medical devices and other things. You know, if someone can hack into, you know, a heart monitor or change dosing instructions and things like that, and, you know, it is possible. We know there's many cases that are out there of hackers being able to do, and it's just a reality. It's just another way to get in and affect a company's or a consumer's systems.
Right. This is akin to thinking about how, you know, a city's water supply might be maintained or electrical supply, right?
Exactly. And, you know, utility companies rely on lots of IoT devices as well.
And moreover, when it comes to home consumer devices, it sounds a little bit like, you know, the equivalent of leaving your back door open.
Very true. I mean, you need to – I always laugh, and we were talking about this earlier, like with great power comes great responsibility. When – I think this is a Spider-Man quote. When companies develop devices like this, I mean, they have the ability to do so many of amazing things, but manufacturers have the responsibility to think about, you know, the security measures that are in place, and consumers of which purchase these devices also need to take responsibility about understanding what that device does and what type of risk. I mean, there have been cases in the past. A lot of the FTC cases have involved, you know, in-home cameras, you know, that have been hacked where someone can view some in their home, baby monitors, routers, you know, internet, you know, enabled TVs, you know, those types of things. So I think consumers need to understand when they bring that device into the home that they do have risk.
I know there are people who, you know, put just a simple piece of black tape over their over the camera lens on their smartphone or their laptop when they're not using it.
Number one thing to do, and I will tell you, you know, the FBI here comes out and does a lot of presentations. The number one thing you should do is on the camera on your laptop or anything like that, you know, is to put a cover on that camera phone, because that's one of the first things that, you know, hackers will look into doing.
Jen Rathburn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jen Rathburn is a partner at Foley & Lardner and the co-founder of the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance. You can find links to more resources and information about cybersecurity and the Internet of Things at WUWM.com.
Do you remember your first car? Of course you do. It's been a while since Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler bought his first car, but it is an event and a car that still occupies an important place in his memory.
With the car show season in full swing a few weeks ago, what could possibly upstage this admitted old car fan from attending the best car show in Milwaukee, you ask? Tickets to the same Sunday's matinee performance of Hamilton in Chicago, my wife answered. There'll always be next year's car show, and when I go, I'll spend most of my time with cars from the 50s. What's so special about cars from that era, you ask? Let me explain. Ah, the 50s. Eisenhower was in the White House, and Elvis was in the Army. And me? In that glorious fall of 1958, Dad and I were car shopping for his first ever new car. What more could any 16-year-old boy want? Visiting the dealerships, slamming doors, kicking tires, and looking under the hoods of Fords, Plymouths, and Chevys, all the time pretending to know what I was doing. I was sorry it had to end, but Dad finally settled on a two-door, three-tone blue Ford. I'd have to wait 3 long years before I started car shopping again. But this time it would be for my car, my very own car with the money from my newspaper truck route. Another difference. I started driving company newspaper trucks 2 weeks after my 16th birthday. What would company lawyers say about that today? Given the 3-year anticipation before buying my first car, can you imagine the excitement when in the fall of 1961, it was actually time to buy my own, my very own first car? There may be a person of my vintage somewhere who has forgotten about their first car, but I doubt it. Now let me tell you about mine. It was a 1955 Buick Special blue and white two-door with a thundering V8 engine coupled with a slower-than-molasses Dynaflow automatic transmission. I paid the staggering sum of $800 for the car. I thought it was a steal. Dad thought I'd been had, and as it turned out, we were both about half right. Every used car of that era had some idiosyncrasies, and my Buick was no exception. Pushing in the cigarette lighter blew a fuse, and all the dash lights went out, and the radio died. Not that the radio was much by today's standards. My SUV, a black box SUV that looks like everybody else's black box SUV, has speakers all over the place. This Buick had one tiny speaker in the middle of the dashboard. But who cared about dash lights and radios? I had my own car, my own set of wheels to take me anywhere I wanted to go, providing I had a buck for 4 gallons of gas. Years pass, things change, even those things we don't want to change. I can't remember the last time I saw a 55 Buick on the road. But for those of my general age bracket, somewhere in the corners of our imagination and in the hollows of our memory, we can still drive our first car. I can see that blue and white Buick sitting in the driveway, freshly washed. It's calling me to go somewhere with its full tank of gas, a rarity in those days. Do I drive around the block, pick up Tom, and head to Rostrelli's for a taste of the best pizza in town? The spicy sausage and mushrooms, please, along with a Coke, a real Coke made with syrup and sparkling water. Or can I find the courage to ask her out? This girl I just ran into the other day. She seemed kind of interested, but a guy never really knows for sure. Thank you, Detroit, for giving me my 55 Buick Special blue and white two-door. For what started out as just a car, now for this old man, has become a time machine. A time machine with 4 wheels, a dead radio, and no dash lights. And did the girl say yes? I was going to tell you, but a guy should have some secrets.
Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler is a retired newspaperman who now lives in Brookfield.
We'll take one more break and then return with our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And for Labor Day weekend, it is Ex Fabula Radio, part of Lake Effect Weekend on WWM. Hope your weekend is moving along just great. We have some stories from past Ex Fabula Story Slams based on a certain theme, and bringing us that theme and the stories is Ex Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney. How are you?
I'm excellent. How good. Goes it by you?
Pretty good. We've got kind of a long title this week.
We do. Well, we are partnering with the Milwaukee Art Museum on a storytelling event on September 7th, and the theme of that is Power, Dissent, and Youth Empowerment. So this particular event, you can enter for free, and you can experience personal and political stories from community members inspired by David Drake, who is a 19th century ceramics maker, and the world of Rashid Johnson. It's going to be a huge event. And so, you know, just like Packer preseason events, this is our preseason before we get into our storytelling events.
And you go through the canon of Ex Fabula Stories, and you can find a few on power, dissent, and youth empowerment.
We sure did. So, you know, this theme is really interesting because, you know, you hear so many adages about youth is wasted on the young and, you know, millennials this, millennials that. But, you know, what we forget is when we put a positive spin on the current climate, you're going to see a lot of youth in Milwaukee that are real positive about making the positive changes. And with the help of impassioned youth leaders and dedicated mentors, I mean, the youth are basically showing us the way. So we have to kind of keep that in the back of our minds. Mm-hmm. We did find a couple of stories from fantastic youth leaders in Milwaukee. And we're going to start our show out today with a story from Jakari Carr, who told a story at our Building Bridges for a Better Milwaukee, which is part of our UWM Service Learning Story series. So let's listen to Jakari's story.
So Jakari Kicks for Kids is a nonprofit organization that focuses on lessening the self-consciousness of being underprivileged so that you can focus on your education. So 3-4 years ago, there was a little boy who had like really huge holes in his shoes, and he attended my mom's daycare. So I would just go up to her daycare, you know, I would mentor the boys, I would help them with their homework, and then we would play sports. So I'm a big fan of basketball. So the whole time I would just interact with this young man and talk to him, I got to like really get to learn him. He's the middle child out of 9 kids, and their family is living in poverty right now. So they really don't have much. So after just working with this young man so much, he let me know. He said, "Mr. Carr, I want to try out for the basketball team. And, you know, I want to be good just like you." Now, mind you, I haven't played any high school sports or anything, but I am actually all right with the basketball. So, you know, I tell him, I said, "We're going to do this. I'm going to train you. We're going to get you together." So when I happened to look down at his feet, it was like really huge holes in his shoes. Like, I mean, if he stepped in some water, his whole foot would be completely wet. So right then and there, I try to think of ways where I can help him, because I know you don't want to try out for a basketball team if your shoes are completely trash, because people are going to make fun of you, you're going to get bullied and things like that. So I had a bright idea. I said, you know what? I'm going to go through social media, reach out to everyone, and see how can I get this young man some pair of shoes. So I went through Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, wherever outlet I can go through, friends, family, and I was able to get this young man a pair of Jordan 6s 2 hours later, brand new. Mind you, he don't have much, so when he got these shoes, he was just like super excited. Almost had me feeling sort of like I was his dad almost. And I just was like, I just felt really good. So I'm like, wow, this is what I want to do. So it was so crazy when I first met this young man. He wasn't doing good in school. He had bad grades. He would always get suspended. He was big on like sagging and like just ways that I wasn't fond of. Since giving this young man these shoes, the young man is on the honor roll now. He plays for his school team, and actually he just had 30 points their last school game. So that really had me like super excited. What I'm doing now, or where my story really comes from, is I was once underprivileged. So that's what made me want to start my organization. I know how it feels to not have the best jeans, the best shoes, and for people to bully you and make fun of you. So I figured if I can give these kids some new shoes, you know, just some new shoes for them to be able to focus and people won't rib them or make fun of them, then they'll be able to focus on their education and they'll be able to get great A's and, you know, be our future doctors, lawyers, and so on. From that point on, which was 4 years ago, Jakari Kicks for Kids have had a fall fashion show to raise money for Christmas toy drives. We have had Stop the Violence game nights, March Madness basketball tournament, which we actually won, so that was pretty cool. And our future plans in the next few months is to transition into a location. So I've been working out of a suite for the last 4 years, and in about a month or two, I'll be moving into my own personal location, which I'm very grateful for. So that's my story of my organization. But besides that, you guys, I would just really love to thank the Siebler office. Ben is like one of my favorite people. They believed in my organization. They helped me out with my Christmas toy drive. So because you guys, that moment was very special for me, and we were able to help a lot of people. So thank you guys. Thank you.
And that was Jakari Carr making a positive change in Milwaukee. Thank you so much, Jakari.
You know, you listen to his story, and Jakari Carr has done more in his young life already than I think I have accomplished in my entire life. He's really a positive force.
So. Yeah, and it's never too late, Bruce. We can all make that positive change at any age.
Exactly.
So the reason we have our theme today, Power Descent and Youth Empowerment, is because we are in conjunction with a preseason Story Slam event held on September 7th at the Milwaukee Art Museum. This is in conjunction with a couple of the artists, a 19th century ceramics maker by the name of David Drake and the work of Rashid Johnson. So come early for brief tours before the Story Slam, which is co-sponsored by Chipstone Foundation. And this is also held in conjunction with 200 Nights of Freedom. So please come by, and if not to this one, check out many of the events that we're having in Milwaukee regarding the 200 Nights of Freedom. It's very special. So with that, let's roll into our second story. This is from Zach Hemerl. He told a story at our Fair Schools, a community conversation with Exfabula Fellows. He was one of our fellows last year, so let's listen to Zach Hemerl.
I'm an English teacher. I've been teaching English now for going on 9 years. And I've taught from the middle school all the way up through the high school. And I want to share a story with you guys today from a situation that happened in one of my eighth grade classes. So, with the student I'll call Jeffrey. He's one of my favorite students. He's a young, vivacious black man. He happened to be homosexual. And he was really, really, how do I put it, flamboyant. He was outspoken. He spoke his mind. He always had something to say. He always had something to contribute. And sometimes he got a little gregarious. Sometimes he got a little over-involved and had to be wrangled back. But he was brilliant, and he was energetic and curious, and he had so many really, really positive aspects to his personality. I run a loose classroom, and I kind of like a call-and-response type of dynamic, and he really fared well in my class. He really thrived in that type of environment where he could kind of shout things out and not be shouted down. However, this was not the case in all of his classes, and he started to run into some troubles with some specific teachers, and as these troubles began to build and build and build, the teacher started to have meetings about him. What are we going to do about Jeffrey? As I said, he was gregarious, and he spoke out a lot in my class, and maybe too much, but I was able to speak with him in an empathic way and help him understand that there are certain moments when you can't be talking. And I was able to work out a system where I could just give him an eye contact and just go like this, and he'd be like, oh, okay, I'll wait for my turn then. but this didn't happen in all the other classes. And so the teachers got together, and all the eighth grade team started talking about, what are we gonna do? What are you seeing in your classroom? And one of the teachers in particular thought that he was getting away with way too much. And it was because he was so charismatic. He would get in trouble, and then he would come and charismatically talk his way out of it, and then it wouldn't get on his record, right? And so what this teacher had suggested that we do was we begin to track his misbehavior so that we can have a record, and so that we can take this record and communicate it back to mom and dad, communicate it back to the principal, and we can say, see, there really is a problem. He did this on all these different days. I was a little apprehensive to do this. I didn't feel like tracking and calling him out on behavior that seemed very natural to him and who he was as a person. But I was a team player, so I just sort of went with the flow, and an email was sent home to mom, and in that email they explained that the team would start tracking his behavior, et cetera, and mom immediately called for a meeting. And we all got together and sat around a table, and mom was very angry. She was so mad, she was shaking. And she was most angry for two reasons. One, why didn't anybody tell me about this beforehand? Why have things been allowed to get to this level? But even more than that, she was upset about this idea of tracking her son, tracking him like an animal, she said. And it was a thing she sort of threw away, but it was a phrase that stuck with me. And after that meeting, we walked out, and she walked with me. And as we were getting towards my room. We started to talk about the things we were discussing in the meeting, and we eventually got into my classroom, and in the privacy of my classroom, things got a bit more candid, and I had to share with her that this phrase she used, tracked like an animal, really struck me. I hadn't thought about that at all. Neither had any of the other white teachers who were sitting around that table. And I just said, frankly, I never thought about it, and I didn't make the connection between this word, tracking, and the history that it connects us to. And what it might be like to be minority, to be particularly a young African-American man in an environment that's 90% white, and to be tracked like an animal. And I said to her that this hurt me, that she felt this way. It hurt me that he felt that way. And the moment I said that, the waterworks clicked. We didn't solve any problems then, but she and I made a empathic connection with each other. And things have calmed down with Jeffrey, but the systemic issues are still there. And I don't know the solution, but I do know this. Words count, and the details matter. And empathy is what we all need. Thank you.
And that was Zach Hemerl, who told a story at one of our fellowship events. If I may, Bruce,
yeah.
I need to mention that we are still accepting applications for this season's Exfabula Fellows program.
I was going to ask about that,
well,
but
I'm
you,
gonna tell you,
you,
all
you
about
stole
it.
My thunder. But yeah, Exfabula Fellows.
Yes. This season, we will be focusing on race and place. For example, so if you have a personal story about your experience with the housing marches or housing access today, or driving while black, feeling welcome or unwelcome in different neighborhoods, et cetera. We're going to be doing a lot of events. We're going to be talking to kids about race again, race and public health. So if you have any stories you'd like to share with the community, please, we are accepting applications until September 12th. So head over to exfabula.org/fellows and join us.
Now, you covered a lot of ground today with the event at the Milwaukee Art Museum, the Exfabula Fellows. We didn't mention that the first Story Slam is coming up in October.
It is.
But if all that slides by on the radio, it's all at your website.
Yes, it is. And it won't be the first time. Get it? The first time.
Ah, that is the theme for that night, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And if you want to hear these stories again or share them or share the information here, you can listen again at WUWM.com, and we'll be back next weekend with more.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up our show today. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned now. All Things Considered is next. It's 4 o'clock. I know.